This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. As a homegrown terrorist organization, the Ku Klux Klan has been a model of efficiency and violence. From its beginnings after the Civil War to the present day, the Klan used racism and fear to persecute African Americans and control much of the political activity of the South. Now, that may not come as news, but it might surprise you to know that during its heyday in the 1960s, the Klan had more members here in North Carolina than all other southern states combined. That's just one of the revelations in a new book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan. David Cunningham is the author and an associate professor of sociology at Brandeis University, and he joins us now. David, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's start right here in North Carolina. You know, this was one of the more progressive states in the South. That was the reputation. How did it become the most populous state for the, you know, card-carrying Ku Klux Klan members?
Well, one of the reasons is I think it is because of the state's progressivism. In a state like Mississippi or Alabama, residents who really felt strongly about maintaining segregation had plenty of outlets to achieve that, all the way from the governor's office down to school boards. Local business leaders were all mobilizing to ensure that segregation would hold. And in a place like North Carolina, the leadership was really clear that they opposed federal intervention in terms of civil rights legislation, but they would abide by federal law. And so what the Klan did in a place like North Carolina was sell itself as the only organization who was willing to steadfastly and militantly maintain segregation. And it really provided a broad niche that the Klan was able to fill.
And I guess to put a point on that, while you have political figures like Lester Maddox and George Wallace standing in doorways as object lessons in their reluctance and refusal to admit African Americans, you have Terry Sanford in 1963 speaking to the North Carolina Press Association sounding like this.
Reluctance to accept the Negro in employment is the greatest single block to his continued progress and to the full use of this human potential of the nation and its states. The time has come for American citizens to give up this reluctance and to quit unfair discrimination, and to give the Negro a full chance to earn a decent living for his family, and to contribute to higher standards for himself and for all men.
There you go. Terry Sanford, the governor of North Carolina in 1963. Clearly there was a niche to fill in a place like North Carolina where citizens' councils, the sheriff's office, and the governor's office weren't the bulwarks against desegregation.
Certainly. I mean, I think the speech that we just heard was, in effect, also a recruiting speech for the Klan. You know, they would hold rallies, and they would be citing what Terry Sanford was saying on the stump. And this would be something that they would very explicitly say, look, you can't count on your political leaders to maintain your way of life. And this is the sort of message that in a lot of white working class communities really resonated.
Now, how did politicians like Sanford and others at the local level respond to the growth of the Klan in North Carolina?
Well, initially, I would say consistently throughout the 1960s, there was opposition to the Klan's presence, meaning you can't find an example of a governor or other political leader in North Carolina speaking positively about the KKK. And so one of the things that's important to understand is if the Klan would hold a rally in a particular community, not only the governor, but also local ministerial associations, often the mayor, all the way on down, would be protesting the Klan's presence. So they never had support among political elites in North Carolina. But that, again, sort of fueled what people who were either members or constituents or curious about the Klan's program would actually be willing or able to do.
And we're talking about 1960s era Klan activity. We should probably step back a little bit, talk about the origins of the Klan following the Civil War, and then I would ask you to tell me how big it was in North Carolina then, in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, North Carolina, when people talk about the Klan, usually you focus on three separate waves. Certainly its origins are, as you say, following the Civil War in the 1860s. There was another enormous wave in the 1920s where the Klan was a national presence with 3 or 4 or 5 million members and lots of political influence all over the country. And then we can think about the wave during the Civil Rights era, as we've been talking about. Going back to the 1860s, North Carolina had a significant Klan presence, and there are lots of outrages. Alamance County was well known as being the topic of a federal hearing on Klan outrages and Klan violence. But it would be difficult to see North Carolina as exceptional during that period in terms of its Klan presence. The Klan was widespread across the South, and North Carolina fit into that, but didn't look different than Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and other southern states.
By the middle of the 20th century, North Carolina does look different. It has a reputation, anyway, as a more progressive state, as we said. Political elites, as you said, are in open opposition to the Klan, and yet it's easy, it seems, to recruit. Who were the recruits, and how was it organized? Why was it so easy to recruit everyday rank and file North Carolinians?
Well, one of the things that the Carolina Klan did that wasn't true in other states was they had the capacity and the ingenuity to host rallies regularly. Almost every night of the year in 1964, 1965, 1966, you'd see a Klan rally somewhere in the state of North Carolina. And so this would draw hundreds and sometimes thousands of local residents. And the way it was set up is really sort of a skewed county fair environment where people would arrive at these rallies and there'd be refreshments they could buy. They could buy raffle tickets. They could buy Klan souvenirs. They could listen to live music. There'd be Klan speakers. And at the end of the night, what the KKK is often most famous for is that they would end these rallies with an enormous cross burning crosses that were often 60 or 70 feet tall. In a very ritualized way. So this was compelling theater. And who it was most compelling for were oftentimes workers who felt their way of life was dependent on the maintenance of segregation. So this whole idea of racial threat, the sense that socially, politically, and especially economically, their way of life would change if the Civil Rights Act was passed and followed in a place like North Carolina, this is what the Klan railed against during their rallies, and this was also what was resonant to a lot of people in these kinds of communities.
So an anxiety about a loss of privilege, about an increase in competition for jobs and resources in general. It's interesting to me that the political elite survived without being, in a sense, sensitive to this or without catering to this anxiety in a way that the Klan proved could be so successful.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of variation across the state. I mean, certainly the Klan's stronghold during this period was in eastern North Carolina, which, as many of your listeners know, was much more rural. It was more centered on an agricultural economy. It had industry coming in, but in very small ways. You'd see small mills, small industry coming in. The Piedmont, as has continued certainly since the 1960s, was growing in a very different way. So the service economy was growing. Industry was often much more large scale. And so what you'd really see is that the Klan's stronghold was in the east. And these kinds of communities where economic life was often very tenuous for everyone, the idea of racial privilege that was maintained through segregation really became something that really defined the economy in a way that was much looser in the Piedmont.
Talk about the leadership of the North Carolina Klan. Was it exceptional, the leader of the North Carolina Klan? I mean, you talked about the organization, these carnival-like rallies that help bring people together. Was the leadership here better than anywhere else?
I would say so. The state leader, what the Klan would call the Grand Dragon, was a guy named Bob Jones, who was in Rowan County in a small town called Granite Quarry was his home. And Jones really pioneered the kind of organization where the Klan wasn't just about terroristic violence. It certainly was about that in North Carolina and elsewhere. But what Jones was very good at was trying to broaden the Klan's appeal and create a whole parallel set of services for its members. So what Jones was really able to do was offer a whole range of social outlets for its members. The Carolina Klan would host turkey shoots on weekends and fish fries. They'd have their own church services. They'd periodically have Klan weddings. You also saw things like Klan group life insurance policies. So they would do this whole range of things. And what the appeal there was is that mainstream institutions that fill these social needs of residents, according to Jones, were compromised. You know, they were willing to not be white supremacists. They were willing to be racially impure. And the Klan could then offer all these things to people in a way that created this parallel, insulated, whites-only space. And that's really something that wasn't achieved in any other state to near the extent that Bob Jones was able to in North Carolina.
And to make it look somewhat more normal, you talked about the carnival atmosphere of the rallies. That could be seen as a, especially ending in a cross-burning, something exotic and special. But then there were the daily marches or daytime marches with people in uniforms, men, women, and children in Klan costume walking the streets of cities in North Carolina.
Yes, but prior to almost every rally, the Klan would go in the late afternoon and do exactly as you're saying, these marches right down the main street of a town. And, you know, what Jones was really trying to do was to create the sense that the Klan was a public presence. It was mainstream. It was normal. And it represented mainstream North Carolinians. So in North Carolina, in part due to an anti-masking law that was passed in the 1950s, the Klan was not an organization where people would have masks over their faces. So you could see who the members were. And to have, say, 200 members in full robes and regalia marching right down the main street of a city really sort of cemented this idea that the Klan was public and it was trying to represent a broader constituency. Jones's favorite phrase that he'd use with reporters during these street walks, he'd say, you know, without our robes on, we look just like people. And he was trying to create the sense that the Klan were really representing garden variety, sort of normal, typical North Carolinians.
David Cunningham, author of Klansville, USA. Our conversation with him continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan during the 1950s and 60s. Author and sociologist David Cunningham is with us. His new book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era Ku Klux Klan. He writes that the Klan had more members in North Carolina at this time than all other southern states combined. What was the role of women in the Klan here in North Carolina?
Well, formally, and this is true of the Klan everywhere, its membership was restricted to white men. But also, and this is particularly true in North Carolina, the Klan really tried to present itself as an outlet for families. And so how they did that was they established a parallel set of what they called ladies' auxiliary units. So where there were a lot of larger chapters, what the Klan would call claverns across the state, they would try to set up an auxiliary unit that was attached to that chapter. And what these units did, they tend to be predominantly made up of members' wives, and they would do things like help prepare things for rallies. They would bake some of the goods that would be sold at the refreshment stand at the rallies. They would try to spearhead charity drives that the Klan would host that would sort of cement their civic image in various ways. And they would really be seen as supporting all of the work that the chapters were trying to do.
What was the relationship between the Klan and law enforcement at the time? They have these big rallies. I mean, was it antagonistic? Were members of law enforcement, as they were in the Deep South, essentially members of the Klan? How did it work here in North Carolina?
It varied quite a bit. There weren't very many cases of active complicity between the Klan and especially local law enforcement, although there are certain well-known cases. Wilmington is one of them, where a police chief and his deputies effectively joined the Klan and provided lots of support for it starting in 1963. But you didn't typically see what you saw in a place like Mississippi, where you'd see oftentimes active collaboration between police and Klan. The important thing, though, was that up until 1966, the state policing agencies, so the State Highway Patrol, the State Bureau of Investigation, would monitor the Klan, but they didn't undertake a campaign to proactively limit or prohibit its ability to organize. So in some ways, while they weren't collaborating with the Klan, and they also weren't being antagonistic towards the group, and it opened up some space for them to be able to do things like host these nightly rallies and really expand their organization.
I wonder what the relationship between the North Carolina Klan and the National Klan is. I've got a tape clip here of Robert Shelton, who is associated with the Klan leadership at the national level. Here's a speech he gave at a Klan rally in the 1960s.
No, it has been this conspiracy, this communistic element, this anti-Christian force that does not believe in God or Christ, that has pitted the white man and the Negro together constantly to keep us attracted and bitterly opposed and bring about the animosity and the ill will toward one another and continuously clawing at each other until they can slip around to the background and grasp control and shove you and I off the table and capture this government.
As Robert Shelton, at the national level of the Klan leadership, he's from Alabama. Was there a close relationship in the message of the North Carolina Klan and Robert Shelton's message in that clip?
There is. That's a really telling clip in particular, because one of the things that Shelton would take pains to do is root the racial critique and the racial ills that he would point to in this broader communist conspiracy and anti-Christian kind of conspiracy. And so he used both those terms in that particular excerpt. And Shelton, as you say, he's from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, really crisscrosses the South and runs a tightly coordinated outfit. So his group is called United Klans of America. He appears at rallies almost every night somewhere in the South. He would always claim that he would drive more than 100,000 miles a year getting to all these places. His star grand dragon, his star state leader, was Bob Jones in North Carolina. So he certainly spent more than his share of time in the state trying to support the work that Jones was doing to organize these chapters on the ground.
Yeah, I'm interested. I know that you had a chance to interview Robert Shelton in 2002, and that was just before he died, about a year before he died. I just wonder how he felt about that. Was he repentant? How was he feeling about his activities by 2002?
He certainly wasn't repentant. He, in some ways, looked like an anachronism. He sort of showed up, his vanity plate on his powder blue Lincoln town car said never, which was the defiant slogan in the 1950s and 1960s to maintain segregation. He would speak of being a Klansman by birthright. And he hadn't been formally involved in the Klan since the mid-1980s when a lawsuit from the Southern Poverty Law Center put him out of business, effectively. He hadn't been involved with the Klan since, but still saw himself and his identity as closely tied to the Klan. So he wouldn't be repentant at all. The kinds of critiques he would make about the communist danger, about sort of the fall of a Christian white Protestant nation, and certainly the racial critiques he would make, he would say very similar things when I spoke with him than he would have in the 1960s.
Very curious about the business community. You know, clearly you paint the picture of a grassroots organization that's extremely popular in North Carolina, even among families. Business community, from all I've seen, was deeply uncomfortable about segregation and felt that it was going to, you know, it was frankly impeding business and bad for North Carolina. They understood the culture. They may have gone along. They weren't active. And I wonder if there were signs, if there was active collaboration with the Klan in North Carolina, the way there was in the Deep South among local businesses.
Well, the business story is a complicated one because, as you note, there are these tensions, especially in a place like North Carolina, which really is making strong appeals to industry that had been based in the North and saying that this is a friendly place to bring industry, to bring business. Segregation was a liability in that sense. So oftentimes business elites in North Carolina were strongly opposed to especially militant expressions of white supremacy, segregation, and militant reactions to the civil rights movement. But also you would get, and if you think about the membership in United Klans of America in North Carolina, you would have a disproportionate number of members who are small business owners, often in smaller communities. So you would often get a lot of ambivalence among the business community. What you didn't get, though, as you would have in a place like Mississippi, is you do not get business owners and elites organizing to maintain segregation. So the whole idea of the citizens' councils that thrived in much of the South, but not in North Carolina, was bringing together and mobilizing business leaders to exert economic intimidation on civil rights efforts and civil rights activists. You certainly wouldn't have seen that in North Carolina. And if anything, the business community really tempered the ability of the Klan and other segregationist outfits to operate effectively.
And what a paradox. I mean, on the one hand, it's precisely because there aren't citizens' councils here that the Klan grows the way it does. And yet, and as you say, they become also the a kind of a form of resistance that holds back the influence and the ultimate power of the Klan. Fascinating paradox.
Certainly, I agree. And you know, one of the things that the Klan was always fueled by is this elite opposition. So the fact that especially prominent business owners would oppose them was something that they'd go out at the rally that night and brag about effectively, say, look at how effective we're being representing your interests. These people are saying that we're not doing the right thing, but clearly we are. And this is something that really allowed them to maintain their membership for much longer than you'd see in other parts of the South. And it really wasn't until the state rededicated itself to actively policing the Klan that you'd see that sort of tide turn.
It's interesting, too, the appeal that you heard in Robert Shelton's bit that we played just a bit ago about Christianity and about the rise of atheism. I mean, this is a mostly Christian place in terms of religious practice in the 1960s. Was there a real sense that there was a threat to religion, that the civil rights movement actually threatened the religion of white Southerners?
Well, the way that opposition to civil rights was framed, and this is especially true in the Klan, but really is something that you would see in a much more widespread way in the segregationist world, is that this is an attack on an American way of life. And predominantly, probably the most predominant place that you would see that Americanism being threatened was in the religious sphere, the sense of a Protestant worldview is going to be threatened. And what was underlying all of this was this looming communist menace. So in a racist sense, there was this idea that the civil rights movement couldn't have actually been engineered by African Americans, because there was no way that they would be capable of being so successful in such a large-scale way. So one of the ways that that was explained in this world is that there must be something else behind the scenes. And so what that would turn into is a set of godless communists, or it would turn into there must be Jews behind this. And oftentimes it was a blend of the two. But in either way, in either version, there was the sense that there was this hostility towards a Christian American way of life.
We may be surprised. I certainly was surprised to see the number of Klan membership, the number of Klan members in the 60s in this state. But it was noted. I mean, there was people took note of the fact that there was a large Klan presence in North Carolina. And one of the ways it seems that the political leadership dismissed it was to say, well, yeah, but they're on the fringe and they're not as violent as they are in the Deep South. And you address that in your book.
Certainly. And that was the line. I mean, the Klan was not underground in any sort of way. I actually have in front of me a volume that was compiled by a librarian at ECU, at East Carolina University in Greenville, named Wendell Smiley. And the volume is titled North Carolina Press Views the Ku Klux Klan. And it's a compilation of more than 800 newspaper articles from about a dozen newspapers across the state about the Klan between 1964 and 1966. And so what you would see would be regular coverage of the Klan's presence and activities and regular criticism of those kinds of things. So the Klan was really prominent in terms of its coverage, but you're exactly right. The way that that turned in terms of political leadership was saying that this is not something that represents North Carolina. This is something that really is on the fringe. And it wasn't until a federal hearing exposed that North Carolina's Klan was not only widespread, but well more widespread than anywhere else in the country and anywhere else in the South. Not until that made national headlines were state leaders willing to acknowledge that this was a significant problem in North Carolina in a way that it might not have been in other parts of the South.
And the acts of intimidation and terrorism are, you know, short of beatings and lynchings, a form of violence, because the intimidation has a violent effect on the people it's aimed at.
Certainly. I mean, the leaders would point to, as you're saying, the fact that there weren't well-publicized murders, acts of significant violence, but you can find, and these still exist in the State Highway Patrol files, in the State Bureau of Investigation files, in the State Archive in Raleigh, you can find literally hundreds of reports of these kinds of acts of intimidation. People who had crosses burned on their lawns, shotgun shells fired into their living rooms, bricks thrown through their windows, people who were beaten up, who were threatened. This would just happen repeatedly, and this is something that the Klan was really good at coordinating in all sorts of ways in North Carolina. So this idea that you can't point to particular murders like the Freedom Summer murders in Mississippi or something like that meant that the Klan really wasn't doing anything that hurt people was really certainly a misrepresentation of the coordinated intimidation that they would be conducting weekly.
By the 1970s, Klan activity was waning throughout the South. But then in 1979, the Klan kills five people in Greensboro during what is now called the Greensboro Massacre. And they were caught on tape. Klansmen and neo-Nazis charged. They were acquitted by an all-white jury. What does that say about the lingering power of the Klan here and perhaps elsewhere? But let's stick with North Carolina for a moment.
Well, that was a terrible and telling event in a variety of ways. One of the things that you see there is certainly the Klan, United Klans of America, which was the group in the 1960s that dominated the state, was entirely a shell of itself, although it still did exist in the state. But what was happening by the mid to late 1970s is that these Klan factions were blending with and allying with other kinds of white supremacist groups, in particular neo-Nazi outfits. And so what you see in Greensboro in 1979 are Klansmen and neo-Nazi members coming together in opposition to an anti-Klan march that was being held. And so what you really see is it's one of the legacies of the Carolina Klan, because not only did it create an organizational outlet for the very fringe members who were still active in the later 1970s, it also created an ideology that would allow it to blend with these neo-Nazi outfits as well, and also spoke to the fact that what had happened in the 1960s in terms of the civil rights struggle hadn't been fully addressed in any sort of way. So when you see the aftermath of the Klan violence in Greensboro, a lot of that was an unwillingness to acknowledge what had happened in the state over the past two decades.
You were on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was formed in the aftermath of that, reported in 2006. I mean, do you feel it's been addressed since? How do you feel about that process?
Well, I played a small role in the commission's process. I helped write parts of their report, but I certainly was a close observer in their process, and I thought that they did tremendous work. This is the first formal TRC, Truth and Reconciliation Commission, effort seated in the United States. And what they were able to do is provide a space through testimony and public hearings for a broad range of people who were impacted by the events in 1979, from people who were directly victimized to people who lived in the community to people who were involved in the Greensboro sort of city structure, to Klan members and neo-Nazi members as well, to air their stories and talk about the impacts of those kinds of things. And the report that was generated, which must run 600 or 700 pages, is both exhaustive but a very important thing. And it's seen as really a starting place. I mean, the report was not the end of the process. It was seen as something that could be used as a resource to continue to further dialogue about what had happened in 1979, but what that also means for the communities that it happened in and for people's daily lives living not only in Greensboro, but anywhere that has been impacted by racial violence.
You say that one of the legacies of the Klan presence here is a kind of overlay of violent crime in those places where Klan activity had been strongest.
Yes, my colleague Rory McVeigh and I have done a related study where we've looked at violent crime rates. And even after you hold constant all of the other factors that criminologists typically looked at to explain rates of violent crime, what you see is the communities where the Klan was most active during the 1960s to this day continue to have significantly higher rates of violent crime. In part, that's really talking about not the fact that Klan members are committing crimes 30 or 40 years later, but really about how organized vigilantism in a community really disrupts the social fabric of that community and can delegitimize authority and create a sense that a way to rectify conflict is, you know, this is something that people can take into their own hands.
It becomes part of the culture and hard to get out.
Certainly.
So, Klan activity today, what's the level of Klan activity in North Carolina?
Well, certainly we see more groups active both in North Carolina and nationwide than we would have in almost any other period. But unlike these past waves of Klan activity, these groups tend to be very, very small. They tend to be quite marginal. But what you see is an extension of what I was noting about the 1979 events in Greensboro, is you see much more blending of lines between Klan groups, neo-Nazi groups, other white supremacist groups, certain kinds of militia groups. And I think the Klan's ideology, symbolism, and rituals have really infused that kind of blended white supremacist world and continue to provide another kind of terrible legacy of past Klan activity.
David Cunningham, thanks so much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you.
David Cunningham is an associate professor of sociology at Brandeis University and author of the new book, Klansville, USA, The Rise and Fall of the Civil Rights Era, Ku Klux Klan. Coming up, The Art of Politics. Stay tuned.